So we're back to considering the Hebel world. Remember that word Hebel? It means, it's translated vanity in our translation, but it actually means something closer to out of whack. It has a wider semantic range, a range of meaning in the Hebrew than vanity communicates to us. And so we have a world that is out of whack. It's not according to God's original Genesis design. And so we look around us and we try to figure out what is going on. And the great questions that the writer of Ecclesiastes is asking through his character, the preacher, are, is it worth it to work, to find any pleasure in work? Is there any use in seeking wisdom? Is there wisdom that's any good in this life? Does it matter if we're wise or foolish? And can we understand why things work out the way that they do? Can we understand why there is such injustice, why the wicked seem to prosper in so many ways and the righteous seem to be persecuted and to suffer? There's also the question of our knowledge. Can it ever be comprehensive? It's very interesting to see the ways in which we seek comprehensive knowledge today. We have Wikipedia trying to gather all the knowledge in the world in a way that no other printed volume has ever done. We see Google Books, and it's now had to cease because of copyright law problems, but trying to make sure that every single book in existence is digitized. And they made a huge effort at that and put millions of books into a digitized form. Now, of course, many of them you're being charged to buy. But there's that impetus in the human soul to be comprehensive in knowledge, to have all knowledge of all things at our fingertips so that we can understand the reality of the world in which we live. And yet we know this to be a vain effort, ultimately. And so, is there a place, however, for wisdom then in a fallen world? And our answer is yes, but it's yes in a very nuanced way. We don't like nuance, and so maybe that's one of the reasons why people haven't been digging into Ecclesiastes regularly in the last 100 years. But wisdom is useful to recognize sin and folly, but it's limited, and we'll see how. And wisdom is useful to recognize our duty, but it's limited, and we'll see how. And remember also, as I was reminded when people say, who is Q? Remind me of who Q is. It's my shorthand, because it's simply easier as a preacher not to say Koheleth 40 times in a sermon. Q is simply my shorthand nickname for the preacher. Koheleth is the Hebrew word for the preacher, who is the character through whom, the Solomonic character through whom the writer of Ecclesiastes is musing on life in a fallen world. And so the first point then, which brings us through to the end of chapter 7, is wisdom is useful to recognize sin and folly, but it's limited. And we'll see how. In a real sense, what we're going to say here this morning is that the greatest wisdom that comes only from above is that we are limited in our wisdom. And so that's wisdom, when we understand the limits of our human understanding. And so wisdom is useful then, though, to recognize sin and folly. And wisdom is superior, he says in verse 19, to wealth and power. So there, it does have a superior place in the scheme of things. And this is very important for us to understand. Wisdom gives strength to the wise far more than 10 rulers who are in a city. So in the ancient world, those, we refer to them as the high and the mighty. It's because they would be sitting in a physically high place in the city and guarding the walls of the city. And they, that would be where the power of the city resides. And so he is simply saying that it is, there's nothing greater than wisdom in terms of a human possession. And the wise is in a better position in this world than the most powerful people in this world. And then he goes on to say that wisdom also teaches us that we cannot deny our own sin. And so just as we might think, wow, I am, you know, as you look through your newspaper and you read about some wealthy and powerful people, and you think, wow, that I'm superior to them because I'm wise, and wisdom, according to the Bible, is better than power and wealth. And as soon as we think this, of course, Q brings us back down to earth and says, but surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Essential to wisdom is recognizing our own corruption, our own sinfulness. In and of ourselves, apart from the grace of God, we are sinners. And the best people on earth are sinners, are imperfect. Rulers and wealthy and all of the rest of us ordinary folks, we are imperfect. And he's setting the stage, of course, to remind us then that our wisdom is going to be limited and it's going to be subject to God's wisdom, if it's true wisdom. And so there are no perfect people. Everyone is a sinner. None does right. As Paul mounts up the evidences against everyone, Jew and Gentile, in the first three chapters of Romans, we see that this is a truth that was already very well known in the Old Testament, because that's what Paul quotes. And he says, don't let the disparagement of others get you down. Here's another wonderful little dig that he brings, that Q is wanting to make sure that we understand that real wisdom is going to have humility as its chief characteristic. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. So we do that because we know that people say bad things about us. We know that there's gossip in families, that there are things that people say behind your back that they would never say to your face. And so what are we to do with this? Q says, you too have done this to others. You're imperfect. And so here he not only says in this general way that no one is without sin, but he tells us in this very specific way that we are natively gossips, that we natively like to take down others in the eyes of others in order to make ourselves feel superior. And if you're aware and even hurt that it goes on concerning you, don't forget that you too have done this to others. It's a wonderful exhortation for us to be humble. Judge not that you be not judged. So wisdom then is to have a humble self-assessment of ourselves as we look in the mirror to remember who we really are in the eyes of God. Q wants us to remember this. I haven't read the article, and now I'm forgetting. I've had so much mail pass under my eyes this last month, I've not been able to really dig into reading it. But it is, in fact, I think it's actually something that came on the web through World Magazine. But it was an article about how the so-called missional church is making everyone feel that they have to be some extraordinary missionary rather than being truly evangelistic and truly faithful in the ordinary things of our lives. This is where God wants us to be witnesses. And so Q is bringing us down to earth, as I think that article, just from reading the title and the subheading, would teach us to be, in terms of some of the temptations that are out there to be extraordinary people, to be extraordinary leaders, instead of being humble Christians in the places where God has put us. And wisdom teaches that we can't understand anything exhaustively. Notice then the next thing that he says is that all this I have tested by wisdom. And so here in verse 23, this word is a very strong word, to investigate or search out or to do what I always hate doing, which is to balance my checkbook. You have to go through and balance your checkbook. I hope you do that, by the way, because banks do make mistakes, and you may think you have more in your checking account than you do. But it's a very exacting thing, isn't it? You know, and I was taught by my dear mother that I'm to go and balance it to the penny and make sure that I know exactly what's there and what isn't there, and that what's been paid and what hasn't. And so he's saying here that he is doing an exhaustive search, testing by wisdom to understand if he can really understand what's past. In a few moments, he'll say, what's future can't be understood either. And we usually easily see that. But we're talking in Sunday school this morning about Josephus and his history. And as accurate and interesting as it is about so many different events during New Testament times and before that, so it's very useful, but it's very limited, because he was writing as a man in some ways defending himself on several fronts, and we can see that there are others who have other facts about that same history, and as we read those histories, as Elder Roland has been doing in preparation for Sunday school, you recognize that you can only know some limited things about the past. But to know it exhaustively? Not at all. It's utterly impossible to know it exhaustively. That which has been, is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? Our limited understandings can find out some things, but not certainly anywhere near exhaustively. We cannot account for the big questions. And this is why God has put us in the situation that he's put us in, because he wants us to seek him and not our own understanding, which is our native tendency. We think we can figure it out. And we oftentimes think that we can't really believe something unless we can figure it out exhaustively. It's interesting. We don't think this about human nourishment and growth. We eat food. We hopefully have a good balanced diet, but we don't understand, and even the greatest minds in science cannot exhaustively understand the nature of nourishment and growth. It's a mystery. There's loads of mystery there. And yet we go ahead and we eat. We base our practices not on exhaustive knowledge, but on essential trust that watching others and the experience of others, we can do reasonably well in terms of eating or many other human activities. But what we're coming to here, of course, is the great question. And, you know, people ask this question, why did such and such happen? Why did I get sick? Why are there viruses in the world? Why is there death? Why does someone get cut down and killed in the military in Afghanistan in their 21st year? Why does God allow this? And we as Christians even are often intimidated by this question, because we feel that we've got to give some kind of an exhaustive answer. But the fact is that we do not have exhaustive answers. What we have is a God who does. God knows the beginning from the end of human history. He knows all the details. He knows everything that's going on in every heart in this room. And we can't even begin to know all of that, even in our own hearts, much less in all of history. He is God. And so, knowing the folly of sin and the irrationality of folly itself is, in this section itself, wisdom. And wisdom teaches us, too, that we can avoid folly. See, some would say in their cynicism, well, listen, if we really have no ultimate control, we can't know things exhaustively, and in fact, sometimes the foolish end up making it better in this world and having a more pleasant life, why bother? Is there any difference? And the writer is saying, you don't need to understand things exhaustively. You don't need to be in control of everything in order to understand that living a wise, well-lived life is far better than living a foolish life. Now, here's where we have to be cautioned, because when you read this next several verses, you look at
you look at what he says about, particularly about women, and you think he only found one man that was faithful and no women. This doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up to my experience, where some of the most faithful people I know are women. And so what is he saying here? Is he a male chauvinist? I don't think so, because remember to think carefully about what Q is saying in a nuanced way. Don't absolutize his musings, and especially in this one. What does it make you think of now when you read about the woman that he's saying we should stay clear of? He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken in by her. This ought to remind us of a whole section of the Old Testament, Proverbs 1 through 9. We have wisdom and folly are being, in a poetic way, are being pictured as two women. One is the harlot, and the other is the godly woman. And so he is not speaking here about his exact experience with women. What he's speaking of is the woman, the harlot, the whore, folly. And she is the one to be avoided. And he's reminding us again that while we still live in a mixed situation, while wisdom cannot find out all that we might wish to know, but the fact is that folly is that which separates us from God. That folly is that which must be avoided at all costs. And even though we cannot completely explain what folly is, we do know that folly will lead ultimately to hell. We don't understand all the aspects of sin and the ways that evil works in this world. But what we can know is, and he sums this up nicely in verse 29, one of the most important verses in the whole book of Ecclesiastes, "See, this alone I found." So he's coming to a kind of summary of what he's been talking about here, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Now notice also the use of the word scheme, because what he's saying is that man is inherently a schemer. But we cannot understand the great scheme of God, that is his plan for all of history and for our lives. So it's very interesting how he's playing these two concepts off against one another. But he's also revealing to us the very essence of what he's saying about hebel or vanity. Notice what he's saying. We can put it now in a little bit different terms here as we look at wisdom. And we think now about the essence of what we need to learn about wisdom is that God made man according to his design. He made him upright. He made him straight. I think back to my counterculture days. Straight was the last thing you wanted to be. And it was very telling because, in fact, the counterculture, as I discovered through my own experience, was full of crookedness in many different ways. The aberrations of sinful rebellion. Straight was a nasty word for us. But in the Bible, straight is exactly the opposite. Straight is righteous and good and true, faithful, dependable. It's what we ought to aspire to, is to be straight. And so, he made us straight. But, they have sought out many schemes, or they have twisted things so that they are now no longer according to design. And that's what hebel means. Out of whack. Not the way God made us to be. And so here, the writer is, in a sense, he's showing his hand now. This is what Q has really discovered is true, is that things are not according to design, and that only God understands the ultimate scheme in which schemers have twisted things all out of whack. And that's what we are as sinners. We are schemers. And this, you see, he says, this is useful wisdom. So you see what he's doing all along the way. And I'd encourage you to go back this afternoon and read through this passage, because there are lots of little details that we don't have time to look at in depth. But what he's doing here is he's going back over the experience of man in a fallen world and showing that while wisdom cannot do what we as sinners would like it to do, figure everything out, but that there is true wisdom, and wisdom understands this above all, that God created us upright in his image, and that we are now fallen through our own scheming and rebellion. And so what does that do? Well, of course, it makes you cry out for a redeemer, for a solution to this rebellion. But of course, Ecclesiastes never explicitly says that. It simply creates, as it were, a hunger for the reality of redemption, which the Old Testament people knew in the sacrificial system of the priesthood, and which we know in the final high priest, the Lord Jesus Christ. Then we move on now to our second point in verses 1 through 8 of chapter 8, and that is that wisdom is useful to recognize our duty. And so this is, in a sense, it's the flip side of avoiding folly, but now we need to pay attention to duty. And what duty does he put first? This is really very, it's not remarkable so much, it is very just poignant the way that he puts this. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. And here he's talking about someone who is like the one that sits in the seat of the scornful. His face is, don't you challenge me, because I'm in control. And now he's saying, if you find real wisdom, your face is going to brighten with submission. To what? I say, keep the king's command. And so here he's talking about God's entire authority structure. We don't even like the sound of that word, authority structure. It's one of the reasons why we're doing Guy Waters in Sunday school, and we'll pick this up for another couple of weeks over the next two Sundays in adult Sunday school. How Jesus runs his church. He has given authority. He has ultimate authority and gives it to the officers of the church. We live in a world where there are kings and rulers who have been given authority by God. And as Americans, one of our greatest attributes is that we're adventurous, we're creative, we love to push the boundaries of progress and find new frontiers to conquer. But the negative of the American character is that we don't like authority. We don't want anyone to tell us what to do. And that's true in the church, it's true in the world, and it's true back in Ecclesiastes, back in Q's day, that it is of the essence of a sinner to be a rebel. And so he's telling us that it's wisdom. You don't need to understand the scheme of things, but what you do need to understand is the value of the duty of being submissive to God's authority structure. This is so important. And I know, as a rebel in the counterculture, what it was to disdain all authority. And I still have to check myself when I disagree with what a president or a senator or someone else, a judge, has decided. It's very easy to let that old rebellion slip out. But it's very important, according to Q. You don't need to have comprehensive wisdom to know this, to obey God-given authority. Now, we know there are exceptions to that, and that's not what we're dealing with here, that we're never to obey when an authority tells us to break God's law or to not do what God has commanded us to do, such as preach the gospel to every living creature. We see in the beginning of Acts where there Peter and John needed to simply submit to their punishment, but they didn't quit preaching the gospel, and they prayed for God's grace to do it. So they submitted to authority in the one sense. They were willing to take the punishment, but they went and did what God had called them to do. But that's not what the writer is dealing with here in these verses. He's saying that there are limits to our wisdom. But the one thing we can know is that following God's
authority structure is something that we are indeed called to do. So, interpreting a thing. Can we understand things? Verse 1. And who knows the interpretation of a thing? Well, that's not the ultimate thing that's important. But what we can know is that we need to pay attention to authority because this is useful wisdom. And so, it is that we see a picture here of one who has been called by God, that is the king, to exercise authority in this world, and we are therefore called by God to respect that authority, and God will bless us. And so we see, let everyone, in the New Testament, says Paul, in terms of Roman authority, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. And therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. It's interesting that as Elder Roland was talking about Josephus's defense of his own taking the side of Roman authority as a Jew, his argument was that those Jews that rebelled against your authority, Caesar, they were wrong. They're not typical Jews who would normally be respectful to that authority. And so it is, then, that we ought to be known as a people for those who are submissive to that authority and not committing ourselves to an evil cause. Notice verse 3. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. Speaking there of the authority and the power of the king. And it's so easy for us to align ourselves with different causes which are angry about something in our society, in our culture. And it's so easy for us to forget that respect for authority is a primary Christian duty that the Lord calls us to here. Now, he also then goes on to remind us what we've been hinting at up to this point again, that wisdom tells us that God is in control of everything. And this is what we might call the doctrine of ignorance. It's interesting. I wrote an editorial a number of years ago and essentially said, called it the theology of mystery. And I got a few people who kicked back on that and didn't like the sound of that. Well, the Reformed, we know a lot of things. We have all this doctrine. We have the Westminster Confession and Catechisms. What do you mean mystery? It makes us a little nervous, that word mystery. But it shouldn't. Because one of the things, if you read through the Westminster Confession alone, is you'll see that everything it says about God tells us that he is mysterious. That we are surrounded by mystery. And it's not that mystery is ultimate. God knows all things. But for us, there is mystery. We know very little. What we do know and what we can know for sure to be true, we ought to hold as being very precious. But the fact is that we don't know very much. And this doctrine of ignorance is a very important part of Christian humility and discipleship. The psalmist says, how great are your works, O Lord. Your thoughts are very deep. The fool cannot understand this. So you see here, the wise person is not the one that says he understands everything. It's the fool that says that. It's the fool that makes that absolutely unattainable statement or affirmation. The wise person says that I don't understand much. But God understands everything. That's the basic position of the Christian disciple. That's the basic position of the believer in all of history, that God is the one that controls. Job says it so well. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. I recently had someone send me a picture from space. And it had a beautiful song connected with it. In fact, I think it was T.C. Wilson. And it's a beautiful, like a three and a half minute picture from the heavenly perspective on earth, and showing thunderstorms happening continually throughout the world right now. There are hundreds of thunderstorms happening, and it showed it all from the perspective of space. And you've got a feeling of the vastness of the universe from looking at this very beautiful video footage and recognizing how true it is then what Job, who never went into a spaceship, could say about God, that he understands the way of it. He knows, he sees everything throughout the world that he has created. And he alone is in that position. We have no ultimate control. He does not know what is to be, says Q. And so in verse 7, we can't understand the past, which we'd seem think would be more understandable because we've lived through it, or there's documentation that tells what has happened in the past. But to know the future is utterly impossible. Only God can know the future. And in fact, so impossible is it that the ultimate thing, our death, our own death, we cannot predict. We do not know when it will occur. And so we are not in control. We have no ultimate control over the lives that we live. We have our duties which are set before us, and we have trust in the living and the true God. These are the things that God has called us to do and has given us the power to do. You think of some of the most brilliant men can be some of the most foolish. You think particularly of Richard Dawkins and his The God Delusion. And it's foolish in a couple of different ways. But the first is the more obvious one, that he looks to us as being to have ultimate control over the world through science. And the second, though, is that he really believes that he has made a good theological argument when, in fact, he has done no homework at all in terms of recent Christian apologetics, some of which is among the most brilliant apologetics that's ever been written. It's difficult because a lot of it is very philosophic, like Plantinga, the great Calvin seminary, and now I think he's at Yale, has written so many different things that were never even addressed by Professor Dawkins. And so there's another aspect of folly. Pride keeps him from exploring the territory in which he's going to now speak authoritatively, even though he is neither a philosopher nor a theologian. But because of his standing in the scientific world, people have fallen down and bowed before this book as if it were better than sliced bread or motherhood. And it's not better than either, I can tell you. But the point is that this is the tenor of sinners, to want comprehensive control and knowledge. And it's the very thing that we as Christians must say is impossible for us. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. And so, to seek the practical wisdom of God, we can have. The practical wisdom says, it's you, Lord, who have all wisdom. It's your ways that are the wise ways to live a well-lived life. And it is you that I have to trust for the questions about the scheme of things, because I cannot know those things. You have the plan. You are sovereign. You are the one that orders all the events in my life, both the good and the bad. And so I trust in you and you alone. Job says it well again. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To turn away from evil is understanding. And so finally, wisdom points us to Jesus Christ, who saves schemers. That's what we are by nature. If we don't know this, then we really cannot be truly Christians. If we don't understand that we are gossips and schemers, that we have rebellion rooted in our hearts as fallen human beings. And it's only the grace of God through the Lord Jesus Christ who has righted this horrible hebel that the world is now under the thrall of. this horrible wackiness of human nature that rebels against God. He has become our wisdom, our redemption, our sanctification. Paul says it so well at the end of 1 Corinthians 1. Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and sanctification and redemption. What a wonderful gospel. What amazing good news. And how Q creates a kind of hunger, all of it showing the inadequacies of fallen human beings to figure out the world or to live faithfully before God, and all pointing in a very subtle but powerful way towards heaven, trusting in the Lord and knowing our righteousness resides in the Lord Jesus Christ alone. He is our only hope. He is the only hope to answer the questions of a fallen world and the world in which we live. And if you don't have that hope, you need to have it today. You need to cultivate it. You need to go constantly back to the Lord and say, I am imperfect. I am grossly imperfect in and of myself. I have no hope apart from you who have sent your only Son to die for my sins and to be raised again in glory on the third day. He is the one who sits in heaven as our great high priest, and he is the only one that has answers to the questions of humanity, the ultimate questions of ultimate meaning, of forgiveness of sins and the resurrection from the dead.